Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are psychologist Joy Osofsky. She's the professor of pediatrics, psychiatry, and public health, and head of the Division of Pediatric Mental Health at LSU Mental Health Sciences Center in New Orleans. Also joining us in the studio as well is Shirley Pitts. Shirley is the Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Program Officer. She works for the Department of Health and Social Services for the state of Alaska. Our topic today is the effects of trauma on childhood and the resulting mental health issues that come from this on children and adolescents. If you've got questions or comments during this next hour, you can reach us in three ways. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Again, the local number, 550-8433. Dr. Osofsky and Shirley, welcome. It's nice to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
You know, I didn't put it on these kind of questions I think about beforehand, but you got to tell us why Dr. Osofsky is here to start with.
Well, this is the week that we're having our Alaska Early Childhood Mental Health Institute. So we've had this conference probably for the last 6-7 years, and so we always try and bring up some experts to share with our professionals in Alaska.
Shirley, or Joy, you have written extensively and researched extensively, and you do therapy.
I do.
Man.
All of the above.
Hard to do. I mean, a lot of national commissions, it looks like, or organizations where you're given input. So I think it's really rewarding to me to be able to get in front of someone who's just so much of an authority on a subject. So hopefully we can take advantage of you today.
I appreciate being here.
Well, tell us a little bit in general. Let's start with some generalizations about the effects or exposure on violence on children. What can we say in general about that?
Well, in general, children's exposure to violence is negative. What happens is it dysregulates them. In other words, they may get very active, they may get withdrawn, and it affects how they think about the world, their cognitive development, it affects their emotional development and their social development. There are circumstances, though, where if the reaction is one that is more supportive, the effects may not be as negative. For very young children, what happens is they can learn not to trust anybody in their environment. They have difficulty relating to people. But if the environment can be supportive, if we can help support parents and caregivers and others in the environment when they're exposed to violence, or if it's a one-time exposure as opposed to a chronic exposure over time, we can mitigate some of the negative effects of violence exposure.
Why are children different in their response than adults? And if so, why might that be the case? And where I'm heading is to help listeners understand why it might be more important to address this early in life rather than later in life.
Yeah, and it's not just the effects on children versus adults. It's also the different ages of children.
Yep.
So if we deal with very young children, they are extremely dependent on their caregivers, whether it's their parents if they're or caregivers, others in their environment, child care providers and others, that they're exquisitely dependent on other people, very young children. So if they're exposed to violence or they're exposed to trauma, they have to depend on other people to help them understand and to help them regulate their behavior. As children get a little bit older, when they get into school age, they have more capacity to cope and they have more cognitive capacity to understand a little bit more, and they're not as dependent. We do know, by the way, though, with adolescents, they can be at extreme risk with exposure to violence and trauma because that's when there may be an increase in risk-taking behaviors. So again, how those in their environment, be their parents or schools or communities, react are very, very important. In general, by the time one reaches adulthood, we do learn some capacity to cope, but our capacity to cope is influenced by what happened early on. So we certainly know there are adults who have much more difficulty handling situations. We certainly do abuse women, for example, have been exposed to abuse and neglect early on or exposed to domestic violence in their home, where they're going to have more difficulty in relationship with other people. But I think the issue, the developmental issues, are extremely important, and also whether it's a one-time occurrence of trauma or chronic trauma over time.
You know, to me, talking to parents as a pediatrician, I often point out, and this is partly to educate me as well, but I point out that children don't have that perspective of multiple experiences that we learn with adults, which can be good and bad, I suspect. But I use the example of that I read one time, if a child is in a room, let's say a three-year-old or so, and a speaker is on the wall and somebody says something through that speaker on the wall, the child may say, "Hello, wall," as if, because they don't have the perspective that that's a machine. It's not a real person. And that comes with learning through experience.
Yeah, and the issue that you bring up is obviously very important related to media violence, whether it's television violence or whether it's video games or, you know, all of the media that children are exposed to now, that often, or even television where they show pictures of war, it's often very difficult for children to differentiate whether this is happening right now or happened a while ago, or whether it's next door or far away. You know, the repeated images we have when trauma occurs in this country, the repeated images of 9/11, the repeated images with Hurricane Katrina, the repeated images now with the shooting in Boston, right, that younger children can't really differentiate. Is this happening over and over again, or was it something that happened last week, and how did it impact on them? So that it's exactly what you're saying. That exposure is very difficult for them to understand, the younger they are.
Mm-hmm. So that seems to me a very important principle for our parents to think about when trying to understand how this may be different for children. Another point I've been making recently, and I learned this from, again, talking to people who are experts on what's going on in our brain, is that our brain is exquisitely good at learning, very good, not good at unlearning. So I use the example, again, I stole from somebody, you learn how to ride a bike, for the rest of your life you know how to ride a bike. Tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike. And that kind of sinks at home. So what kids are learning early without that perspective you're talking about of what they see on TV and games and so forth is there. And then it can be difficult. So things that are happening early in life that get reinforced and continue, it gets harder and harder and harder to affect that. Is that true?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
So, for example, parents have the responsibility, need to take on the responsibility of, for example, very much limiting the exposure that children have to some of the media violence or even the news or that type of thing, and also being with them and explaining what's happening. In terms of learning and unlearning, the brain, there's a lot of plasticity to the brain, and the younger children have even more plasticity, and some people have referred to it as a use it or lose it mm-hmm. machine in many ways, so that there are many, many neuronal connections that a baby's born with, and then over time they are pruned. You know, some stay, some go away, and they organize in different ways, and the brain is very plastic in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And how they organize then depends upon experience. Mm-hmm. So it's a nature-nurture. And children come in the world ready to learn and ready to experience what goes on, and that's mm-hmm. why we have a responsibility, parents do and others, to make that environment as positive as possible and as reciprocal as possible in many ways.
Shirley, I'm sure you are well-versed in this whole idea. I've known you for a long, long time. And I guess that's one reason why the state might be involved in early childhood education and early childhood mental health is the idea to make impacts on all of these issues as quickly and as early as we can in life to maximize the possibility of better outcomes for our children.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Thad. We have, my mantra is kind of follow the science, because I think the science is really taking us down to some solutions that perhaps we knew before, but we didn't have the scientific research behind it. And so now it's really pretty clear, learning what we've learned about brain development and how significant these early years are in terms of how kids' brains get wired, the shape of that brain, what it looks like, what parts get really well developed. We know more about what that looks like. And we also know, back to Dr. Osofsky's point, this whole relationship-dependent period where little kids are so dependent on the caregivers around them and the kind of nurturing that they get and the experiences and the impact that has on how their brains develop. So for us at the state, we're looking at that's a logical time to put some energy and resources because it has such a long-term impact.
Mm-hmm. So for children, young children, it's what they see their mother and father or in particular their caregivers doing has a greater impact or more likely to have a greater impact than other adults, other children, other inanimate thing, TVs and videos. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it is because children are very dependent on their parents for their safety, their feeling of safety and nurturing. And, you know, parents are their go-to person. So let's say a perfect stranger behaves to me in a certain way. That may be very unsettling for me as a young child. But if I have that nurturing caregiver to go to help me feel safe and comfortable, mm-hmm. that has a bigger impact. Mm-hmm. And kids are looking for that mm-hmm. with primary caregivers.
And we've kind of alluded to it, the reinforcement of the same behavior. So if mother is always there when you are hungry, when you're needed, that's good. If, you know, occasionally we're not all perfect parents, but it's the cumulative effects over long periods of time that are really important, which gets back to this multiple experiences and trauma to some degree, I would think.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important. I've always admired the work of Donald Winnicott, pediatrician, psychoanalyst, who talked about good enough mm-hmm. parenting. You talked mm-hmm. about good enough mothering, but right. good enough parenting, that nobody's
right.
perfect.
Right.
But if there is consistency and reliability and a child can count on something. And one of the issues with trauma that's very important to realize, which is why the parents or caregivers need so much support, is that if the child's been traumatized, there is certainly a good probability that the parent or caregiver's been traumatized, and it's much more mm-hmm. difficult then to be emotionally mm-hmm. available to the child and give the child what they need. So we have to see it as a system as well. The other thing that I think that the listeners might be interested in is we've been talking about that. There's been a lot of work, as we say, in the last decade and a little bit longer than that in translating the science of early childhood development into understandable ways. One of the groundbreaking books that was published was From Neurons to Neighborhoods a number of years ago in, I believe it's 2001, by Jack Schoenkopf and Deborah Phillips. But what is available for people to look at if they're interested in more material related to brain development and stress is a website called the Center for the Developing Child at Harvard, where they've taken a lot of this information. Jack Schoenkopf took the lead at this, also a pediatrician, to translate this complex work into very understandable pamphlets and booklets that are downloadable and can be shared. I've actually shared some of them for the conference, and I think it's very, very important information that people can gather.
I was not aware of either one of those, so I was scribbling those down. We're always looking for more information ourselves and then to share with patients and parents in particular. So let me remind listeners once again, my guests today are Dr. Joy Osofsky. She is head of the Division of Pediatric Mental Health at LSU Health Sciences Center and an expert in early childhood trauma. And also Shirley Pitts of the Division, Department of Health and Social Services with the state of Alaska. Our topic is childhood trauma and its effects on mental health. How do you get in hold of us? Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. We'll be here through the end of this hour till 3 o'clock. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So how does the effects of trauma vary through the various ages of childhood and adolescence? You had alluded that that's an important issue to understand as well.
Well, what we see in very young children is generally there'll be changes in their behaviors and in their emotions, and we're all actually very much aware of that. So in a one-year-old or a two-year-old, particularly as the child gets a little older, two or three, you can often see more aggressive behavior. They have difficulty regulating that behavior, and you also can see the withdrawn behavior. And the other thing that you see that I find very, very frightening and always look for is a change in what we call affect or emotion. So if you smile at a one-year-old baby or even a nine-month-old baby, you get a smile back. You know, you get that reciprocal exchange that's so rewarding for a parent and also very important for development. If you have a child who's been traumatized and been exposed to a fair amount of violence, you may just get a bland affect and no response at all at a very early age and a young age. And to me, that's quite scary because you should be getting a range of emotions in early childhood, and often with a lot of trauma or violence, you don't get that. As the child moves into the preschool years, again, what's most evident is difficulty controlling behavior. So they'll may have difficulty in the family controlling their behavior. If they're in preschool, they have difficulty. They hit and they can't sit still and they can't learn. They have trouble concentrating. And then as they move into school age, you see continual problems with difficulty concentrating, with difficulty learning, getting into trouble, not being able to sit still, getting in fights with peers and that type of thing. And then it just progressively can get worse with no intervention. So then you get truancy and they may get into risky behaviors, substance abuse, other types of risky behaviors that occur as children can occur with children get older with no intervention. And children, as you were talking about learning before, children learn by what they see and what they experience. And if what they see, for example, in a home where there's domestic violence or a lot of fighting, if that's what they see, that's what they learn. And they repeat it, and they don't learn to negotiate, and they don't learn that there are other ways.
So that becomes their normal. Is that fair to say?
Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're going to repeat, or they're getting reinforced constantly, that is normal.
Yeah, there's also difficulties with self-esteem as they get older. You know, when they're younger, they may have difficulty trusting and relating to other people. As they get a little bit older, difficulty with self-esteem, if you're told you're no good or if you're not reinforced positively, you start to think that about yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's very problematic. Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, I got a ton of questions related to that, but let's go ahead. We have a call. Scott, you're on line one.
Hello?
Yes. What can we do for you?
The topic here, well, I wish that you would discuss epigenetics.
Wow.
I had just read that whether it's abuse and neglect or nurturing, either side of the coin is passed on to the next generation, if it isn't, I mean, it can be worked on, so it's not like some congenital disease, but it is passed on. If it isn't really addressed in one person's life, it can go to the next mother, etc.
All right.
Anything on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. It gets to a deeper aspect of the nature nurture question. So
long term.
All right,
but it's again, I just
So for listeners, the idea of epigenetics is something that's grown out of our deeper understanding of genetics. And genetics are passed on from offspring to offspring from their parents. But it turns out that during your lifespan, there are environmental influences that put marks, make changes in our genes that are not necessarily hereditary. And by those changes, different genes get turned on and off at different times. And as a consequence, that is how the environment is, in a sense, affecting our genetics. And surprisingly, there's increasing evidence that those changes that happen to our genes during our lifetime can be passed on. the classic experiment that got us into this was identical mice reared exactly the same, which you can do unbelievably well in a laboratory. You take two pregnant mice that are identical, and you feed them differently, and their offspring have different colored coats to their fur. So demonstrating that something in the environment, in this case it was they were adjusting food, can affect physical characteristics. Anyway, that's what the gentleman is talking about with epigenetics. I'm not sure how much we're into the epigenetics of psychology, but Dr. Osaski, you have any comments from this?
Well, it's obviously a very important question. I'm neither an epigeneticist nor a neuroscientist.
Right. A
certain amount of information help us understand the nature-nurture issues. At the same time, I believe very, very strongly in prevention and early intervention, and that we can make a difference early on. And so I find in terms of a perspective for the work that I do, even though some of these issues are really, really hard, I really feel like we can make a difference in those ways. And I very much respect the other types of science, but that's
so
where
if,
I stand.
So if epigenetics can make us have consequences that are negative, the environment can, then the environment may be able to affect that in a more positive way, is kind of what you're saying.
I would hope that
if that all happens. Or another way of thinking about the nature-nurture argument was always the answer both.
Absolutely.
It's not one or the other as a rule.
You know, if I could mention, just simply because I think this is really complicated stuff to get your head around. And so one of the websites that has kind of helped me put this in a level that's understandable is if you Google Utah and epigenetics, you will find a website that makes this pretty digestible. It's got some good visuals. It takes you through some of the... It's got one thing called lick your mouse. And so you take your own mouse, and by clicking multiple times, you see what happens to the hypothetical mouse.
Right.
And it's supposed to represent the amount of nurturing that a person would get. But I think that's the hopeful thing. At the same time, it's kind of, really? This is going to pass from generation? But it's also hopeful because I think it tells us that environment does make a difference. And if we could provide some positive times, that will be good genetically for kids.
You amaze me, Shirley. I wasn't going to bet that you knew what epigenetics was. I'm impressed.
Thank you. I've been studying very hard.
All right. Scott, we didn't get a great answer, but we're helping. It's an interesting area of research. Let's take David. David, you're on line one.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I are in the process of adopting a little girl who is exposed to methamphetamines in utero during development. And as we've tried to figure out what that's going to mean, I've read a few of the studies, and I was startled by your guest's comments about the effects of trauma on the development and behavior of these little kids as they get older. And it sounds very similar to at least this limited work that's been done on the putative effects of exposure to methamphetamines in the womb. And I wonder if that sort of drug exposure, toxicological exposure, could be considered a trauma. And also we've also wondered if some of the effects that they're measuring aren't really effects of the drug so much as the environment that these kids come out into after the fact, and which can't be achieved apart in the study. And finally, some studies have pointed out there are some differences in the development and architecture of the brains in these kids, and I wonder if children who are exposed to trauma at young ages also exhibit real architectural differences in their brains.
There's another issue I don't think you really brought up. If you did, I apologize, but these kids also have the genetics of their parents as a substrate upon which the methamphetamine and the environment work.
Right. I mean, we're all victims of our
deep. Right. So what I'm pointing out is very, very difficult question to answer.
But an interesting one.
Yep.
And an important one. And one of the things, I'm glad you brought up the issue of brain architecture, which is what Jack Schoenkopf and the group who work at the Center for the Developing Child at Harvard, I don't know if you've seen that website, you just have to Google the website, where they actually, I asked them, a number of the neuroscientists working there, about why they called it, you know, brain architecture. And they said, well, it's a little bit like building blocks. And architecture seemed to be a word that would describe how the brain develops. And we also know there's a lot of plasticity in the brain in terms of development early on. So I think all of the things that you were bringing up are really important. And it also made me think about the literature that our host, I'm sure, knows about very well, related to work that's been started many years ago on preemies, where if you had a preemie in an environment that was dysfunctional and not very positive, that the development of that child was not as good by a long shot as preemies who were in an environment that was nurturing and reciprocal and loving. And one of the things that occurs with substance abuse exposure with babies also is that even increased inability to regulate their behavior. And so I remember that I was consulting with a group of, I work a lot with abuse and neglect, with a group of foster moms who had actually, they were fostering cocaine-exposed babies. And one of the things that occurs is a lot of dysregulation. And so it can be very frustrating for the parents. And once the parents knew there were other people who were experiencing that and ways they could support the babies and be available to them and, you know, get a break and get some extra support in that way, it made a difference. So I think the more knowledge that you have in adopting a baby like this and knowing some of the kinds of things that may occur, being ready for them and ways that you may deal with them will certainly help the baby's development and help the relationship with you and your wife and the baby as he or she develops. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, it is. It is helpful. And my just a last thought was that it seemed like a lot of the sort of behavioral mitigation that parents and caregivers have to give to traumatized children, it sounds a lot like the same sort of behavioral mitigation that these kids who are exposed to certain toxicants in utero have to get. I mean, like you said, being reciprocal, being loving, putting them in a nurturing environment can kind of mitigate all of these effects that seem related.
Absolutely. And some of the children who are exposed to trauma, they're exposed to different types of trauma. It may be that they have substance abusing parents. It may be that they're exposed to a domestic violence. It may be they're exposed to community violence. But we work a great deal within the child welfare system where many of the babies have been exposed to substances in utero and then later on and in the environment with a family where methamphetamines are used, you know, we know that there's a lot of dysfunction in that family that the children are also, babies are also exposed to after the baby's born. So all of those factors, I think, are very important. And yes, the principles we're talking about with trauma would be consistent with what we're talking about here.
You know, I think that's kind of the dilemma is when you have something like this, it's so complex. What caused what? Was it in utero exposure? Was it the environment? But how we respond to kids, I think, is your point, is consistent, caring, nurturing, responsive caregiving. And we may never be able to sort out all of the factors that, you know, how much of this is epigenetics or whatever, but how we interact with young kids is consistently the same.
And the more one goes in with eyes open and recognizes that things may be difficult and there may need a little more support at times or something like that is very, very important. And there are those of us who work in the field who are available to give that support. And in Alaska, where you are, there are many people available to give that kind of support or intervention or treatment or whatever is needed.
So I would say that we all should get more than just childbirth education. We should all get parenting education. And then there are some higher risk situations where we need more detailed education. David, I think you sound like you've got a good jump on the basic education. And what Dr. Osofsky is saying is perhaps at times you may benefit from a little bit deeper understanding of these issues.
Absolutely. I appreciate the fact that there are so many concomitant and confounding variables. It will make it impossible to tease out what's causing what. But I was encouraged by the fact that it sounds like the same sort of principles are applied for multiple problems.
Right. And routines, consistency, responsivity, reliability is very, very important for all parenting.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
I've been at this for 30 years plus, and your mind keeps jumping back to things that you've heard. And I remember years and years and years ago that the single most important factor that determined the outcome of a child with cerebral palsy or any neurologic problem was not how much physical therapy they got, not how much speech therapy, it's how much the parents understood what was going on. And it's the analogy here is couldn't be better. We all need to be great parents when the time comes and have a better understanding of all this psychology. Well, I can't believe it myself, but we're halfway through this program already, so I have to take a break and remind our listeners you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. Kristen Spack, our engineer, has already put on a link to the Harvard website that's been addressed and the Utah website. So if you go to alaskapublic.org, you can find that link on our website. As a reminder, our local number is 550-8433. You can email us during the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Joy Osofsky and Shirley Pitts. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line One, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line One, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And our topic today is childhood trauma, its effect on mental health. It's been a wonderful first 30 minutes, and I want to encourage people who did not hear the beginning to go back to our website, alaskapublic.org, find Line One link, and listen to the program if you want to get up to date. There are also some added links from the early part of the program that have already been added as well. Dr. Osofsky is the head of Division of Pediatric Mental Health at LSU Health Sciences Center in New Orleans and an authority on this topic. Shirley Pitts works for the Department of Health and Social Services in early childhood education and systems. You can call us locally during the next 25 minutes or so, 550-8433 if you've got comments or questions about today's program, and you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. And as usual, please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday evening, that's a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to help you answer the question. Dr. Osofsky, talking about symptoms of children, I got the impression you mentioned that behavioral issues, affective disorders where kids don't express the happiness, the joy, maybe the inquisitiveness that kids normally would, and that they often act out and maybe lead to more behavioral issues were important symptoms. Are there more we need to expand on that from a symptom standpoint in children?
Well, one of the things that for those of us in the field of infant mental health, aside from me being a clinical developmental psychologist, we have a field that we call infant mental health. We even have a diagnostic criteria, DC 0 to 3R, diagnostic criteria 0 to 3R, because we feel that DSM for, the diagnostic manual that is used for children and adults, does not elaborate sufficiently on the younger children. We know we're going to have, for people who are interested, a DSM-5 coming out very soon, and we're also revising the DC-0-3R. But that's all to say that there are certain categories that are often given to children who are exposed to trauma without necessarily looking at trauma in their background. One of them that's used and overused a great deal is ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where if a child can't sit still and they can't pay attention and they're aggressive and they're acting out, people are quick to diagnose that as ADHD without even talking about or thinking about or asking questions about what goes on in the background. You know, if they've been exposed to domestic violence, if they've been exposed to some other kind of violence in their background, they're exposed to community violence. And I think it's very, very important to pay attention. We would like to see trauma screens, frankly, in pediatric offices, mm-hmm. in emergency rooms, pediatric emergency rooms. We'd like to see mm-hmm. trauma screens because we feel mm-hmm. like we're missing a great deal that could make a big difference in terms of prevention. Mm-hmm. That goes with a broader category that I'm concerned about that I'll just allude to and we can get back to it, of having more trauma-informed systems, mm-hmm. that's child-serving systems. Another category that we see thrown around now with really young children whose behavior is erratic is, and I'm sure you've seen this, and I assume it occurs in Alaska, as people are labeling bipolar disorder.
You betcha.
In very young children. And that's just, you know, children, if you think of a normal two-year-old, a normal active two-year-old, their behavior changes all the time, you know. But if they're exposed to trauma, it's going to change that much more. And if it's a temper tantrum that lasts, you know, 15 minutes, it might last an hour, you know. And if there's no one in the environment that helps them regulate that behavior, mm-hmm. it gets more and more out of control. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the kinds of labels that we're seeing put on children. Now, some of the ones that we use frequently, we sometimes use ADHD. Obviously, that is a diagnostic category. We see a lot of anxiety disorder. We see depressive disorder. We see disruptive behavior disorder characterizing children who, you know, may have trauma in their background as well. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is we need to be asked those questions. And once we ask the questions and learn more about it, then be able to give the children and family the support that they need.
So I got to look at it the other way around, in a sense. I'm seeing the kids who were being asked by the school, is this ADHD, for example? And you're broadening my whole way of thinking about these children dramatically. So the question becomes, what percentage of kids who might have a diagnosis of ADHD or bipolar really have as their fundamental issue early exposure to trauma, which has led to dysregulated behaviors?
I think that's a very, very important question that we need to look at.
Yeah, I've not seen this addressed in the pediatric literature that I'm recalling.
And I think, I don't want to get into the technicalities of it, but I think some of these issues are going to be brought up more with the changes that we're going to see in DSM-5 in mm-hmm. some ways that's mm-hmm. helpful. But I think that the other issue that we're talking about is, you know, many of the systems are saying, well, they want the child to be on medication related to ADHD or
sure.
or what change sure. this behavior with medication.
And do it now.
Yeah, and we work, I train child psychiatrists, right. you know, and right. child psychiatrists certainly learn uh-huh. a lot about medication.
Right.
What they learned from us, because I don't do medication, is, you know, there are other ways to look at things and mm-hmm. other ways to do the evaluation. And, you know, some parents don't mm-hmm. want that. They want the medication.
Right.
But that
right.
we really can do a lot if we do look at that mm-hmm. history and work with that history and help stabilize mm-hmm. that environment so it can be more supportive for these children.
Mm-hmm. Shirley?
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to address that because I think that's the issue, is not just take the surface symptom, but really to do a better job of investigating sort of what the history of the kid's been and what kind of environment and what kind of supports and all of that, just to do a full assessment before we make some judgments about things. And, You know, one of the places, and maybe this is slightly off track, but one of the places at the state that we're trying to make some headway is we're looking at what's called adverse childhood experiences. And I'm not sure if you've discussed that on the show, but that's some of the research that was done when they looked at 10 different adverse experiences kids experience and what happens as they grow older. So the study was really done on folks in their mid-50s. And they found that those folks who were exposed to early childhood adverse experiences or childhood adverse experiences went on to have more health problems as well as mental health issues. So we're trying to look at that. What are all these ACEs, as they're called, that we're seeing in Alaska, and what's the long-term impact? So it's looking at things like maltreatment, but it's also looking at, is someone in your home have a mental illness? Separation and divorce? Is someone in your house incarcerated? Is there domestic violence? So there are a variety of ACEs that can have really long-term impacts.
And this may be very interesting to your readers, the listeners, another link that you can put up there is Google the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, the ACEs study that was originally done by Vince Folletti and Anda. And who were at Kaiser Permanente, and what is really interesting when you asked before about the developmental kinds of issues with children is depending on the number of adverse childhood experiences they're exposed to, you do see both health risks and mental health risks as they get older. And health risks actually in adulthood, including, heart disease and cancer in addition to depression. So I think it's very important. I get very excited when I learn that we have this data in Alaska.
We're just at the initial stages of that, but we're starting to take a look at it.
Mm. Let's take another call. Joan, you're on line one.
I wanted you to be as specific as you can with regards to what are the parenting behaviors that children need. What kind of a parent do children need to grow up healthy? I think that it would help listeners know kind of a checklist. Am I this kind of parent? Do I do these kinds of things? It would be helpful for primary prevention to address that, I think.
Great comment. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a very important question, comment that you make, and that's why I brought up earlier this issue of good enough parenting.
Mm-hmm.
That it's very hard to be a, quote, perfect parent, whatever that is. That we all make mistakes. And with a continuum, I think it's important to recognize those things that are most important in parenting. And I know there's a lot of information out there and different things that people are following, and young people and, different fads and this type of thing. Consistency is very important. You heard me say routines. Routines are extremely important. One of the things we see in families where there's dysfunction, whether it's trauma or whatever the dysfunction comes from, is there are no routines. There's no getting up routine. There's no bedtime routine. There are no meal routines. There's no schedule during the day and routines in some ways, and that's very important. Being emotionally available, not just there, not just with the child, but at least sometimes being 100% emotionally available to the child. One of the things we talk to parents about where there's a lot of stress in the household is when the child comes home from school or when you get home from work, and I'm talking, depending on the young child, or you pick up the child at daycare, put aside 5 minutes. I know that it's great to have more than 5 minutes, but for some families, 5 minutes is a really long time. Let that child choose what you do together and give that child 5 minutes of undivided time or something like that. There are a number of things in terms of that will make a big difference with parenting, and we're not always going to be consistent or reliable. And then also listening. Listening is really very important. Being there for the child. And listening to what they have to say and how they say it. There are all kinds of, things that we could talk about, There's issues of physical punishment. There's issues of yelling. There's issues of no. There are all kinds of things like that. But there's some basic principles that we know do help children grow and develop well and develop some empathy and concern for other people and that type of thing. And some of them are very basic. I would think that, you know, the other two people on the line here might have some really excellent suggestions to add to that.
I think if I had to narrow it down and make it as maybe as concrete or simplistic as possible, I think safety is an issue for kids, knowing that they have somebody who they can go to for safety. Regardless of what happens, I've got you to run to. And I think knowing that somebody unconditionally loves me, and however you convey that as a parent, you know, that's your family tradition and culture. I'm sure that has an impact. But knowing somebody is ridiculously in love with me is really important for kids.
All right. Joan, you still with us?
I am. I'm with you.
You get that list?
I appreciate what you're saying. there's so much more, and I would like you to go on and on just because we're trying to prevent the trauma.
Yeah.
We have to prevent the trauma so parents don't come prepared to be parents.
But, but Joan, if the trauma occurs, and it occurs a lot of times when we can't do anything about it, you say you have a family that's, you know, where things are going along pretty well, and a major significant person in the family dies, or there's a traffic accident, you know, or something like that, then people come together, are able to give each other and the child enough support to be able to get through it, because traumas happen.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the other thing I would add, sort of a framework that we're promoting here in the state is, it's called the Strengthening Families Protective Factors Framework. Mm-hmm. And it really looks at five things that families need to stay strong. And it's really kind of focused on parents. So the first one are, can we help parents become more resilient, meaning that they're more confident in their abilities, they can manage their stress and problem solving. We talk about, can we help families get more connected with other parents so that they have a social network to rely on? Is there available parenting information, child development information, because that helps all of us do a better job as parents? And can we help families connect to services? So if you need something, do you know where to get it? And then the fifth protective factor is really about kids, and kids who feel good about themselves can identify their own feelings and have a good way to sort of express those and deal with those, make our job as parents easier. So how do we enhance those skills in kids? And so, you know, those are protective factors all of us need. And so we're trying to support programs to help families develop those protective factors.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. We're in our last 10 minutes, and there are lots of things to cover. One of the things I would throw out as perhaps important is we've alluded to the fact that parents bring their own problems sometimes to the mother, the parent-child interactions early in life. So I want to expand that point a little bit further and ask what we know about the long-term impacts of significant trauma on children that goes untreated into adulthood?
Very important question. And we do clinical work with young children and families. We do clinical work with children of all ages and adults as well. There are not infrequently situations that come up where a parent will bring a child in because there are disruptive behaviors or there's something else. And after we do a thorough evaluation, really, we realize the problem's in the parent. The problem's not in the child. And yet the parent is not willing to recognize and address their problem, whether it's depression, whether it's exposure, domestic violence going on, whether they've had abuse and neglect early in their life or sexual abuse that they don't want to talk about and deal with or something like that. So we see that not infrequently in terms of the issues with the parents and try to deal with it as sensitively as we can. We'll work together in the dyad and then some individual sessions with the parent to try to help them with that. But there still is a stigmatization related to mental health and seeking mental health treatment You know, we move out into communities, we work in primary care, we work in settings, in schools, we work in settings where it's much easier for families to access services and, in fact, can reach many more people that way. But we recognize there's a stigma. People will say, I'm not crazy, I don't need to see someone or something like that. So I think that this is something that's come up frequently recently with all the terrible, terrible violence and shootings that has occurred. Mental health issues come up. And why weren't mental health issues addressed? And could we prevent if we spent more time focusing on mental health issues? And I think one of the issues is destigmatizing mental health in that way and letting people know, you know, if you're feeling depressed, you know, or if there are things, you know, you have your own ghosts, you have your own issues, demons that are bothering you. There's nothing wrong with going to talk to somebody about it and getting that kind of help. And I think that's one of the issues. And then, you know, ways to even talk about that in settings that are more comfortable for parents in many ways. I like the idea that Shirley was commenting about getting support from other parents as well, which is important.
Shirley, any comments?
Well, I think one of the things that we bring forward as we go through life, we look at our own self-esteem, as you mentioned, Joy, but we also look at how we solve problems and how we react to things, and how we react to stress, I think, is pretty important. So let's, hypothetically, if I'm a young child and I've experienced trauma and I haven't had a nurturing relationship to help me cope with that, then, for example, I may develop a very low trigger for stress. So it doesn't take very much for me to lose it, you know. Mm-hmm. If I'm a young kid, maybe I have a peer who takes a toy and I just fall apart. Maybe when I'm an adolescent, somebody tells me they don't like my hair that day, and I give them a hard time. Or I become a parent then, and my child has a tantrum, and I have a low tolerance for stress. So I think our ability to manage stress can carry forward, can be a long-term impact. And I think our confidence in our ability to solve problems in healthy ways can be impacted. But so much, you know, if you look over the course of a lifetime, there are so many influences, whether it's our peers or our teachers or our parents. You know, there's a lot of influence on who we become. But I think if we have unresolved trauma, it impacts us in very subtle ways that we might not even see or know about. And if we could just deal with some of that, it may change our thinking and how we behave.
You know, it's actually reminding me of a mom who came in to see me. She was feeling depressed and upset, and she had a two-year-old and having trouble handling the two-year-old. And this was a woman with resources. It wasn't she wasn't necessarily a dysfunctional family or that type of thing. And every time the two-year-old would hit, or, you know, normal two-year-old hitting, she would lose it. And she didn't really understand why and what was going on. And as we explored it, turns out she was abused as a child. She'd never talked about it. It was just what happened. It was the family she came from. And then somehow there was a recreating and triggering when the two-year-old was hitting. And when she started to understand that, she was able to, you know, deal with it much better and understand it. So we talk about, some of us in our field talk about ghosts, and there are ghosts in the nursery. And those are the kinds of things that we grew up with, that all of us grow up with different kinds of things. You know, we're very lucky if we have a wonderful early environment and nothing happened, you know. And if we have developed a capacity to cope with them one way or another, then we will recognize and be able to deal with it. But if they're lingering there and get in our way, that's when the problems occur. So I think it's more awareness and able to talk about it, and that could make a big difference for people.
One last topic in our last three or four minutes here is that we've identified the issues. I think anybody who doesn't believe in psychology and the importance of parenting and so forth needs to listen to the program. I think it's gone well enough to help people understand that. And we've talked about prevention, but we haven't talked about the success of therapy yet. And I think that needs to be, in a short period of time, addressed. How good are we at addressing these issues? And I know I'm assuming it's going to be more difficult the longer the issues have been in existence. Or the more multiple the traumas.
There are good evidence-based treatments now. for very young children, child-parent psychotherapy as children are just a little bit older, parent-child interaction therapy as they get a little older, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. There's good evidence that all of them work, implemented, you know, by people who are trained and are willing, and the clients are willing to be motivated enough to continue through with the treatment.
Good.
So we do have good evidence-based treatment, but we all, in addition to the evidence-based treatment, more prevention could make a difference. Prevention, you know, reaching out to families, you know, certainly home visiting. There's very good evidence about that being a very effective prevention for high-risk families. More prevention in child serving systems, whether they're child care centers, or preschools, pediatric offices, et cetera, can make a very big difference. And so I think if we had some systems change in that way and were able to, again, have these systems be more trauma-informed and not have to stay away from it, saying it's okay. You know, we can talk about it, we can recognize it, and then figure out how to be more supportive to families when trauma occurs.
All right, so we got 2 minutes. Let's summarize. What do we want people to take away from this program? We're not going to remember everything. So what are the important points? Shirley, what are your important points?
Well, I think an important point is to start early and to make sure that our youngest citizens in our state have what they need to really develop into healthy, strong people. And I think another takeaway is really that we need to do a good job of supporting families, because those are the environments where kids are dependent on. And so how can we reach out to families, support families with young children, and make sure that they get what they need?
I think it's very important to recognize that there's a relationship. There's a relationship of a parent and child, and we have to deal with the issues that are there for the child as well as the parent and help support that relationship. I've emphasized prevention and how very important prevention is, and also trying to be able to talk more about trauma, recognize it does impact on young children and children of all ages, and be able to talk about it and deal with it, and also help families where trauma has occurred to be able to reach out and get the kind of help that they need that is available to them.
Okay. Great. So I want everybody who's listening today to go to alaskapublic.org or tell their any parent that they know that it's a very useful hour to listen and try to get the information out or the idea, the concept of the importance of early childhood interactions on long-term mental health and probably some physical health, as we've alluded to. Thanks very much. Dr. Joy Ososki and Shirley Pitts of the state of Alaska.
A pleasure.
All right, if you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org as well. And we'd like to know your thoughts about our program at that same address. Why not tune into your health next week when our guest will be lead vocalist and guitarist for the rock band NED. And oh yeah, she just happens to be a cancer surgeon here in Anchorage. So why not tune into your health and learn more about Dr. Joni Hope and gynecological cancer Monday, May 6th. Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.